KZSU FM Stamford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stamford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today, I'm very excited to have joining us from the Netherlands, Professor Geert Lovink. Geert is one of the, most interesting and very, very important theorists in media and how the internet and how communications operate today, and in fact how the internet interacts with our social environment and how we interact with human beings. There's a lot of stuff going on in Geert's work, and we are going to focus our discussion today on two primary areas. First, the book that Geert wrote called Zero Comments, Blogging and Critical Internet Culture, that came out a couple of years ago and was translated into English and published by Routledge. And we're also going to discuss, in connection with Zero Comments, some of Geert's recent writings with respect to Google and how search has impacted the internet and how it impacts our technology. There have been a growing group of media critics who have attempted to move our discussion beyond the very black and white, good, bad dichotomy that exists when we talk about how technology operates. And Geert is one of the early people who focused in that area and has encouraged us to think more deeply about these issues and really try to analyze what is going on. In Zero Comments, Geert focused on blogs and the nature of blogs and how blogs reflect not only what we do as human beings in socializing, but also how we view technology and where technology can bring us and where it cannot. So we are going to focus heavily on Zero Comments and also discuss the, certainly the recent happenings with respect to Google and how Google operates. And of course, Google's prevalence as a dominant force on the internet requires this level of discussion. So Geert joins us by telephone from the Netherlands. He is the director of the Institute of Network Cultures at Hogeschool van Amsterdam and associate professor of media and culture at the University of Amsterdam. Zero Comments is only one of his many books. He also wrote books including Uncanny Networks, Dark Fiber, and My First Recession. So, with that short introduction, I do want to get right into our discussion with Geert. Geert, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dave. It's a privilege, and it's great to speak to the audience in California.
And I'm very excited to have you here, and the honor is mine. Geert, let's start off because, as you've indicated, this is an audience where some may not be familiar with your work. So I'm going to ask for a more detailed introduction. Talk a little bit about your background and how you got interested in focusing on these issues.
Sure. Well, I was trained as a political scientist and done a lot of activist work in the anti-nuclear movement, environmental movement, and squatter movement here in Amsterdam, but also in Berlin. And then I kind of more specialized on media theory. I lived in Berlin for a long time, and I'm certainly part of the German media theory tradition. English has been my first language ever since 15 years or so. So I switched a bit between languages. I kind of consider German my second, and it's only, you know, Dutch is my third language at the moment. So it's kind of, it's a bit of a European story there. So with that, maybe I, you know, can also indicate where my intellectual interests are.
Yes,
or
please.
How my, critical engagement moved throughout, let's say, the last 20 or 25 or so years. I think 20 years, the fall of the Berlin Wall is really important in my biography for my generation. I was involved a lot in the support of dissidents at the time, and it kind of coincided really strangely, of course, the fall of the Berlin Wall and my first engagement with the internet. In fact, when I visited San Francisco for the first time in August 1989, and there were a few people who, you know, who told me all about it. It was the time when Mondo 2000 was quite up and rising and very influential underground newspaper. We just had the first big international hackers conference here in Amsterdam, in which I also met a lot of folks from New York and the West Coast for the first time. Yeah, that kind of defined my my biography. But, you know, as you know, I am not an American. I am a European intellectual, if you like. I am a media theorist. I'm not so much of an academic. I came to academia much, much later, only in 2003 or 2004. So I worked for, you know, in this field for 20 or so years outside of academia, and that's, of course, quite unusual in the States. It's quite difficult to work there independently as a cultural critic and organizer. Of course, that's much more possible, though, you know, it's a difficult freelance existence here as well.
Right.
But, of course, yeah, that's kind of shaped my my biography very much so.
The interaction, and certainly one thing that I've tried to do with Hearsay Culture, is to attempt to bring voices from outside the United States here to the U.S. by way of the radio and podcast medium, to really encourage this interaction and to just spread knowledge. And I'm curious, given your experience in this field, spanning a few decades, how much interaction you've seen among your colleagues?
You mean with the internet culture at large?
Yes, correct.
What kind of interaction?
in terms of sharing ideas. I mean, we in the United States, we tend to sometimes have a myopic view of the world, and I'm curious, with your perspective, interacting with other media critics, how much interaction you found exists or doesn't exist?
Well, that's, of course, a mixed bag, because on the one hand, there's a thriving, let's say, independent cultural scene, and you know, maybe more intellectual culture, although that's on the decline too if you look at it over a longer period of time. At the same time, there's, of course, less direct involvement with the technology as such, which you know, in the US is much more prolific and direct. The U.S. is leading that field, but the problem in the U.S. is always that it's either business or academia. Huh? So either you're an dot-com entrepreneur, or you know, you can't stop talking about you know, the lack of parking space at your campus and the problems you have in your tenure procedure. So so that is kind of you know, I find limiting. And we have in Europe, we have the kind of unique opportunity, at least if you take it, if you see it, to kind of develop a more cultural approach, if you like, to more emphasize the role of aesthetics and the role that designers, activists, and other creative and cultural workers can play in shaping the technology, because this is what my whole work is about.
Mm-hmm.
What It is not to be an outsider, not to be a kind of cliche European cultural pessimist who is standing on on the side preaching the apocalypse. No, my whole program is to develop a radical and critical agenda that kind of develops concepts that can then, be implemented. Because if you look, just to give a simple example, if you look at free software and open source, these are concepts, these are principles that have been first developed in people's heads, and then people started to understand, hey, yeah, there's something into that. Mm-hmm. We can turn that into code. We can turn that code then into software, into user cultures, and into business models. Yeah, the role of concepts in this whole process is absolutely pivotal. So we then have to ask ourselves, who are actually inventing these concepts? Where do they come from? And how do they grow as kind of memes, as cultural, genes, as Richard Dawkins once described? How do they grow? And I think that from a European perspective, we emphasize a lot the very negative approach in that. It's absolutely important to deconstruct what we do. And we see that as a very creative and positive activity. Criticism is not something that, is just negative in the sense of taking things apart. No, it is a culture that emphasizes reflection, that emphasizes that from the thinking process we get to the new.
You mentioned in the book, and it's a nice segue, that you encourage your colleagues in Europe who are stereotypically viewed as grumblers to turn that grumbling into a source of energy. And I think it's interesting and something that we've chatted about, but I do want to mention up front before we get into your theories and what you've written about, is that you are also a radio person, and I think that's part of perhaps the way that you've attempted to move from merely the sidelines to actually impacting a policy. So very briefly, and we'll get to it towards the end of the show, but what is your radio background?
Oh, yeah, it's great that you mentioned this, Dave. I came to radio just a few years before I kind of got really involved in internet culture and in the early bulletin board systems and so on, the predecessors of the net. It actually in the same month as I purchased my first personal computer in the fall of 1987. And I started here in Amsterdam working for the free radio stations, the pirate radio stations, who at the time we had three or four of them. Very lively culture of experimentation, sound culture, DJing, also very much intercultural. So I was glad to honored to participate and to contribute to that from an intellectual perspective. It was probably one of the few radio shows that so uncompromisingly focused on theory, much as your program gives space to thinkers and critics without diminishing their work to the length of a soundbite. Mm-hmm. To give what we at the time called royal space to theory was really important, and I think it still is. To give space to the development of ideas is still in this culture. In which people exchange, ideas and have to minimize them to 140 characters, is still a utopian activity.
That's right. That's right.
And I've done that with great pleasure from 87 to until I moved to Australia in 2000 when I arrived. In Australia, I had so much other things to do, to build up a whole new existence, and it wasn't really possible to fit in the radio production. So recently, we've digitized this archive. We've curated it and brought it down to 200 one-hour programs, which will become available over the next few months. On archive.org. In fact, one of San Francisco's wonderful nonprofits.
Outstanding. Well, I look forward to hearing these shows, and I think you've stated better than I have really what is the main purpose of the show, and certainly much better than I have ever explained why I do a show that is 1 hour, notwithstanding the very boring reason, which is that KZSU puts shows on in 1 hour blocks. It can be longer, but not generally less than 1 hour. We're talking with Geert Lovink on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Geert, let's start off our discussion with something which is the details of our discussion with a very hot topic, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well, and that is Google. You've written about Google quite a bit, and I'm just going to ask you this open-ended question. If you were to define what Google is, how do you define Google?
Well, funny, I think they're at a turning point themselves at the moment, and it's very interesting. Next week we've got a big conference here that I organized. I've been working on it for quite a long time. It's called the Society of the Query. It's a 2 days international event. It had two predecessors in Maastricht in 2007 and another one-day smaller event last year called Deep Search, which took place in Vienna in Austria. So here in Europe, we're kind of course, very slowly trying to catch up and understand the cultural implications of this whole shift that we see in our culture, which goes way beyond Google itself, and that is a shift, from let's say information to search. If you want to know something, you don't go to a source. You first, formulate a question. Which means that our whole approach towards information is becoming search-driven. And that kind of shift of culture even extends, I think, to education. Of course, that's controversial, whether education as such should become query-driven, whether we should say to our children, if you want to know something, then just look it up, right?
Ask
the right question and just find it on Google. Of course, and that's where the whole controversy starts. To what extent should we, in fact, let our lives be driven by search as a principle, and now I'm not talking about Google as a company,
right?
But of course, we know that especially for ordinary people, they can hardly distinguish between Google, the company, search, and the internet. Recently, I heard someone saying at a birthday party. It was a woman. She was just working in a factory, and she said, "I no longer use the internet. I use Google." I think that there's a lot to be said for that. To take such a obviously wrong observation you can laugh about, but to take that very seriously, And I think for a lot of people, this is kind of, you know, it just means that they no longer browse, for instance, they no longer surf, they just no longer use this kind of opportunity that, you know, the unique World Wide Web once offered to us, namely that we have links and that we go through links from one to the other and so on. The web becomes, but this is an, you know, almost a banal observation. The web is no longer a space that is link driven. No, it's search driven. We all know that. But then, you know, it takes a bit of time for us, for cultural theorists, intellectuals, and so on, to really think that through. And unfortunately, the whole business literature around Google. You know, and I find this really unfortunate of these corporate consultants. They don't seem to, you know, reflect on these fundamental shifts that we have in our culture. If we look at the Google literature, it just glorifies the founders, the venture capital, the Eric Schmidts, and so on. And that is something that I think we should really criticize and say, no, we don't want this management literature anymore. We can't see it. We can't hear it anymore. We need thorough theorization of the enormous implication that this one company has, or we could even say that this very mechanism has, because I would say that... you know, search goes a bit further than Google. Now, if we want to say, you know, why Google, or what should we do about it? Of course, you know, I would love to kind of delegate that to Brussels and Nelly Smith Cruz, who is now, you know, really dealing only now with the true monopoly power of Microsoft, and the EU is in a lot of you know, court cases with Microsoft, and whether, you know, Google goes the same way, becomes a monopoly that you know will be faced with the similar legislation and so on and so on, anti competitive legislation. It's something, you know, that we can discuss, but it's not something that you know, I focus on too much in my work. I find it important that a big you know, Google tribunal will take place here or in San Francisco, and that we really go against these mighty media giants. But I think it's a bit too early to take that kind of political and activist stance. And what we first need to develop is the very you know, tools, the critical tools, the concepts with which we can start to understand. Without an understanding of it, because the changes are going so fast, without an understanding of it, how can you you know, start to fundamentally critique these kinds of corporations?
We're talking with Geert Lovink on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. And I should mention that this show is being recorded on Friday, November 6th. So your conference, Geert, just for clarity for listeners, will be during the week when the show airs, because it will air next Wednesday. Geert, let's talk about some of those critiques, because you make a number of interesting points here, and I do want to discuss a bit more about Google before we turn to zero comments and blogging. But one of the observations that you mentioned here and that you've written about is that we've lost serendipity in how we search. And you mentioned it earlier with respect to asking questions to get your research. You know, I guess I have a two-part question there. I mean, first, why is that bad? I mean, what is your concern with respect to the loss of serendipity? And is it similar to your critique that all we can do is prepare for free collaboration, the open source type projects that are expounded now? Is that the related concept? Tell us a bit about your views with respect to serendipity.
Yeah, well, we all might know that you know, the query outcomes on Google are manipulated, and that you can buy them, and that there's a whole politics of ranking, and we could go really into that. You can even in my school here. In School of Interactive Media, students have to follow a course called, you know, search engine optimization. This might be all too obvious for those working in the media industry, in advertisement and IT. The problem, of course, is that there are more than 1.7 billion internet users right now, and are they really aware, you know, if Google is really, or if the search engines, as, you know, in general, are people's prime advisor, if these tools are pointing people, you know, where they should go. You know, we absolutely need to have a better understanding of the very information architecture of these tools. And I don't see much of that happening in general culture. You know, if you look at television, in magazines, or you know, where can we find any of this information? And that leads me to the point of you know, the absence of internet critics and of internet criticism. This is a serious problem, because look at literary criticism or theater, film, you know, all these activities, all these industries, cultural industries, developed through criticism, because it was the critic who set the standard, who developed some kind of idea, you know, what's good and what's not, and steered debate and so on. And you know, that is, of course, still important. If you look at the theater, the critic is still important. Or look at bookmaking, or writers, what they do. Films. Just think of films. In the whole world of internet, this fast growing web, we have you know, a very few kind of independent thinkers. My big example is, of course, Nicholas Carr, who has this blog called Rough Type. He's the author of The Big Switch, recently rewiring the world from Edison to Google. There are a few examples, but by and large, very, very few. And this means that the users are, by and large, you know, determined to just follow what's exposed to them through the market. And yeah, in terms of search, this becomes quite critical, because who is defining, you know, what is going to be on the first three pages of your search query? Well, that's the whole issue that we're talking about here.
We're talking with Geert Lovink on KZSU FM Stanford Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture, and continue to support the station. Geert, even within our bracket, we can only touch tip of the iceberg type things. And I do want to turn a little bit of our attention to your book, Zero Comments. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, Zero Comments focuses on the phenomena of blogging. And I think for those people that blog or read blogs, they could deduce what you mean literally by zero comments in the blogging context. That means no one has commented on your post. But why did you choose that title? What are you attempting and what are you trying to convey in titling your book Zero Comments?
Yeah, because of my reinterpretation of the word zero. Mm-hmm. It means nihil. It also means, you know, to phase out or to ignore, to overcome, to phase out the centralized media structures of the 20th century. If I say zero comments, it means that my comments are zeroing out the influence of the established media corporations and media structures. And I think blogging, in my view, has that kind of empowering moment that what, you know, others call citizen journalism or call, you know, citizen media, that very activity of blogging adds, you know, to the decline of centralized media and meaning structures. And that is causing a lot of confusion and it's causing a kind of new culture of uncertainty. You know, what is right and what is wrong? Who is saying something? Who are you? Who are you to say this? Because in the past we knew who people were. They were entitled, you know, as presenters, as journalists, as commentators, and the rise of bloggers really points at you know, a very deep reform, a restructuring in society. What, you know, you could enthusiastically also call the ultimate radical democratization of the media landscape, right? And that is also giving us, you know, enormous, fantastic insights and possibilities. But of course, you know, in times of trouble, in times of crises, you know, it could also unleash very unpleasant social forces and trends. Blogging, as we know, it came into being, really established itself after September 11, 2001, and it's certainly not associated, you know, necessarily with the progressive and kind of hippie social movements of the 1960s and afterwards. So blogging really came into existence in a quite divided and corporatized and you know, conservative culture in the U.S. in Europe, but elsewhere too, in which a lot of people kind of started to express very populist ideas and started to kind of question what the kind of neoliberal establishment of the traditional media were kind of repeating over and again.
The focus of, as you indicate, the focus of Zero Comments is blogging, and I perhaps I'm going to jump forward a little bit because you made reference to Twitter anyway and the 140 character limit, and recently I've started to read and started to hear more and more people saying that this new technology, Twitter, even Facebook, is starting to kill blogs. And I'm curious to get your reaction to that. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Is there any judgment that can be made?
Yeah, killing is maybe not the right word, but first of all, it presents itself as an acceleration, of course, of blogging.
Right.
It is. It speeds up that type of exchange, because these are a few remarks around you know, a URL that points to another site. This is this is kind of how, you know, Twittering starts, and if people do it in the right way, they still do it within the spirit, let's say, of micro-blogging. And in that sense, it doesn't, it's not all that different from, let's say, you know, the very early definitions of what blogs is, namely, it's a comment around a link of a single person. You know, we just go back to David Weiner's definition as the blogger who is, you know, the single person who speaks. And I really like that. And there's something in Twitter that kind of still refers to that. But yeah, what you're saying is right. What it does after it has gone through that process of acceleration of communication and exchange is that there is very, very little space anymore and emphasis on the more longer and reflective blog postings that really start with a comment, maybe on an outside link, but then kind of bring in the depth and the comments of that single author. And it is through the longer blog postings that we really get into kind of new insights and new critical concepts, if you like. And that is very, very hard on a real-time medium like Twitter.
And I've noticed also, just on Facebook anyway, that at least with my experience using Facebook, and I understand that you don't use it, but I have seen this phenomena play out in an interesting way, in the sense that from time to time, some of my quote-unquote friends on Facebook, and some quite frequently, will post insightful snippets, as you mentioned, with links or what have you, and perhaps a comment to it.
Yeah.
But what leads from there is actually the kind of information that a couple of years ago I would have expected to see on a blog. You actually see people debating the point that was made, and some insights are made. And the interesting thing is, and it's something that I think you've commented on, within the realm of Facebook, I can benefit from seeing that debate, but of course the structure, the architecture of Facebook means that only the friends of those people would actually see the debate, whereas blogs have been created to be more pervasive and more widely accessible. So from that perspective, as we see Twitter manipulate, if you will, this mode of communication, what do you see as the outcome to it? Because, as you mentioned, it is a closed architecture in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, especially with Facebook, also, of course, we see an enormous, well, it's not really a balkanization of public internet culture. It's a complete fragmentation into tiny, tiny bits. And it is a destruction, you know, of a once very lively public culture into you know, a private conversations within these so-called walled gardens. And this is an aspect of social networking sites, you know, that to my taste has not really been thoroughly discussed, because people thought at first, of course, quite rightly so, that these were just, you know, additional tools, that it was something new that you would just have on top of all the other things, right? It presumes that all the other stuff just continues. But, you know, we live in an attention economy, and even if you spend long hours on the internet for whatever reason, private or or for business purposes, for whatever you do there, you only have an X amount of time. So these social networking sites are very, very time consuming. So in that sense, they do add to the disappearance of a once quite lively, a public culture in which people who disagreed could still meet. And because of this ridiculous emphasis on friends, there is no more possibility to meet other not like-minded people. This is a core problem. From a perspective, of course, of social mobilization and so on, if you have a cause, that's wonderful. But if you think that the world is about a bit more than just meeting like-minded people, and that you think that discourse is also something that needs to be revitalized and renewed, and that the discourse is not something that is given, that you just take out of some books but that the discourse, critical discourse, is something that is vital to, for instance, democracy. We have something that we should really worry about.
We are talking with Geert Lomink on KZSU and Hearsay Culture. Geert, I think this is really an important critique and observation that plays out in any number of ways. As I think about how I use Twitter effectively as the equivalent of a repeater station in a radio context to merely put my content, which I link directly to my Hearsay Culture blog, to a wider audience. And yet, when I choose who to follow on Hearsay Culture, from time to time, I have thought, if other people see that I'm linked to X or Y, will that matter? Because of this echo chamber effect that people make judgments based on who your friends are. And of course, we've been making those judgments since human beings began breathing in oxygen and letting out carbon dioxide. But it also reflects something significant with respect to the show as well, in that I've resisted having one medium through which I broadcast the show. I broadcast on KZSU to an audience that's listening to the radio station in the more traditional way, but then I also broadcast the show by way of podcast through literally three separate media: iTunes, the webpage of CIS, and hearsayculture.com, in an effort to get to these different audiences. And so I think this observation that when we have a closed universe that only allows for certain, not only certain like-minded people to access, but certain people with access to certain technologies and inclinations to use them, I think that that's something that we do have to think more about. And this is one of the reasons why I find your work quite interesting.
We should be quite cautious not to become nostalgic,
Yes.
This is always a problem with the position of a radical critique, that you end up saying, it was much better in the past. Of course, there was a lively a culture on Usenet. There was a culture of mailing lists, and forum software that, gave us the possibility to very constructively disagree amongst us. And this is increasingly not marginalized, but it is not updated, let's say. The culture of debate and discussion is being excluded by the Web 2.0 developers. Why? It's quite simple. Not because these are evil geniuses, but because they naively think that people will just continue to use all these older tools anyway, because they're geeks. They use the forum and mailing lists and email software, you know, extensively themselves. The problem is, and this is what I see with my students, with the younger generation, that they hardly look anymore at email. They think email is so boring. Mm-hmm. It is so, you know, 1994, just in a way that they also look at blogs. And they say to me, yeah, but that's so 2004, you know. That kind of thinking, well, you know, it sounds kind of cute, yeah, because it means that, you know, they're real hipsters, they're only using the latest and so on. We can kind of have a laugh about that and understand what the young people, you know, of course, they're attracted by the new, and with all our baggage of cultural studies and so on, we understand the mechanisms of pop culture and so on. But, you know, this is really something that we should think about more, because the Internet has these fantastic tools, but the tools alone don't make a culture. The tools can be there and can be completely, you know, ignored, and they can disappear, not because they're not being upgraded or because some company takes them off the net. No, simply they disappear because there is no longer a thriving user culture. We are the ones that kind of create but also reproduce these user cultures, and with them come certain values, I think. And for me, internet culture is also one that, you know, it's very closely associated with a kind of revitalization of the public domain, of disagreeing with each other, challenging each other. Yeah, and this should again, you know, be implemented in code and be presented to the young generation as the latest cool thing to do.
We're talking with Geert Lovink on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Geert, we only have about six minutes left, which is where I start asking the unfair questions. That is, questions that cannot be answered in the time that we have left. But I do want to touch on this issue of coolness and new media. A few weeks ago, I had Bill Patry on from Google, and he's written a book, as I'm sure you're familiar, where he talks a bit about the issues surrounding the debate about copyright law in the United States being hampered by vitriolic language. Now, you've written about the issue, of course, of language in the context of our discussion for quite a while, and you focused from the broader perspective of how we structure the Internet. I want to ask you, you know, how is language important in our discussion, and how do mythical events fit into the equation?
Well, if we move to, you know, a news river, as Dave Weiner calls it, or, you know, if we look at the translation of it, of Google and its latest product called Wave, there's a big shift happening, of course, from the archive away to real-time exchanges. Why I'm saying this is that, you know, if I hear the word language, I really think of kind of comprehensive texts, and I think of the archive. And of course, language is you know, is many things. Language is also, you know, what we use now in this conversation that we have now. Language. And Walter Ong is a media theorist who wrote about this. You can find it in the writings of McLuhan too. The kind of shifts away from that Gutenberg kind of written culture of texts towards what Ong calls secondary orality. And there is certainly, you know, recently again another kind of wave, another shift towards kind of capturing or understanding and then translating that into technology, into applications of that real-time orality. And Twitter is certainly, for me, you know, a move in that direction. How can we kind of harvest, this would be the Google perspective, how can we economize that enormous buzz of these 7 billion people on the planet that are constantly talking to each other, right? I have the feeling that over the next 5 to 10 years, internet is massively moving in that direction, away, let's say, from the archive, away from comprehensive text culture. And ironically, this also means for Google, away from, you know, from search, because the search engine traditionally, you know, has mainly searched larger comprehensive texts. And this is why that recent deal between Google, Twitter and Facebook is so interesting in that respect, because Google, in order to survive and maintain its dominant market position, it has to systematically starting to harvest these small snippets of real-time conversation. This is the big shift that I see happening right now, and language plays an important role in that. Language in the sense of living spoken language.
We are talking with Geert Lovink on Hearsay Culture. Geert, in our last 2 minutes, literally, I do want to ask you, given that you're a prolific writer, what is your next project? And for those people that want to learn more about your work and read your work, obviously they can pick up Zero Comments, but where else can they go?
Our website is networkcultures.org, and you'll see there not only the outcomes of the Society of the Query Conference. Next things that we have coming up here is an ambitious research program on Wikipedia. I think Wikipedia, you know, deserves much, much more attention of critical scholars. Research into Wikipedia so far has been merely technical and focused on quantitative data. And most of all, also, it was done in-house for in-house purposes of the Wikimedia Foundation, the one that is running Wikipedia and a lot of the other wiki-related services. It's very exciting for me to say that this is a collaboration between India, between Bangalore and Amsterdam. So it's kind of an Asian-European thing. Even with Indian money, and that's for me so 21st century, you know. It's the first time, it's a very excited moment when you first receive, you know, Indian seed money for a project.
Congratulations. Geert, I want to thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I've been really enjoyed this discussion. I'm sure the listeners have as well. And I invite you back on the show to continue our discussion. I'm very excited to mention a number of upcoming guests on the show related to the work that Geert does. I'm very excited to announce that Professor Manuel Castells will be on the show discussing his book, Communication Power, which came out this year. Professor Castells is perhaps the most prolific writer in communication theory, not only in the United States, but indeed in the world. And so I'm very excited to have Professor Castells on early next year. Professor Chris Kelton Nolte will be on the show discussing his book, Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software. Another important media critic, Siva Vaidya Nathan from the University of Virginia, will be on discussing his book, The Googleization of Everything, which definitely relates to the work that Geert does. Kazis Varnelis from Columbia University will be on discussing his work, as well as Professor Alex Halavay from Quinnipiac University discussing his book, Search Engine Society. Professor Wendy Chun from Brown University will be on discussing her work in internet theory and communication. Professor Bobby Qual from DePaul University School of Law will be on the show early next year discussing her most recent book in copyright. Professor Tarleton Gillespie, a fellow at Stanford Center for Internet Society and author of the book Wired Shut, will be on the show in a few weeks, as well as Laura Denardis from Yale University and director of the Information Society Project, who's written an interesting book in how governments operate with respect to technology. And Subha Ghosh will also be on discussing his work in copyright, as well as Professor Frank Pasquale and Danielle Citron from Seton Hall University and University of Maryland, respectively, who will be on the show early next year discussing their work in fusion centers and on fusion centers. As always, there are a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can tune in to KZSU Stanford at 5 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays and find the show live, and that's the best way to get the show. But if you choose to listen by podcast, you can also listen to the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find all of the previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. You can also pick up the show through the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu and subscribe to the RSS feed, or you can go to iTunes and find the Center for Internet Society's page there, where you will find not only Hearsay Culture, but all other events occurring at the Center for Internet Society. As always, I welcome your comments, feedbacks, and suggestions at Dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, that's Dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you've enjoyed the program, and please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.